Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs and Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. For more about Inforum and its upcoming events, visit the Facebook page at facebook.com/inforumsf or follow InforumSF on Twitter. You can also watch past Commonwealth Club programs on Fora, F-O-R-A, Fora TV, Fora.tv. Tonight's discussion, Reduce, Reuse, Recycle, Let's Talk Trash, is underwritten by Levi Strauss & Company. I'm Joel McCower, Chairman and Executive Editor of Green Biz Group. This week we celebrated Earth Day, an annual opportunity to take stock in all that's good on our planet and all that needs to be done. And you don't have to go back very many Earth Days to see how much things have changed in the world of trash and solid waste. It wasn't that long ago that the idea of zero waste was exotic, futuristic, some ideal that seemed perhaps unattainable. But today, dozens of General Motors and Toyota assembly plants around the world send nothing to landfills. Same with 25% of Procter & Gamble's and 50% of Unilever's factories. Cities like San Francisco and Seattle are well on their way to achieving zero waste goals. There's a Zero Waste International Alliance with affiliates from Sydney to San Francisco to Scotland. And as you'll find out in a few minutes, yes, you can try this at home. But there's still a lot of work to be done, getting individuals, families, companies, and communities to change how we think about the value of waste and resources is slow, and it's often frustrating work. In our fast-paced disposable lifestyle, there's still plenty of trash out there. So how do we get from here to zero? That's tonight's topic. I'm joined tonight in our discussion by Jared Blumenfeld, Regional EPA Administrator for Region 9, which includes Arizona, California, Hawaii, Nevada, the Pacific Islands, and 148 tribal nations. He's also the former head of San Francisco's Department of the Environment, where he initiated San Francisco's 2020 zero waste goal. Bea Johnston is a zero waste lifestyle innovator whose blog and recently published book, Zero Waste Home, shows how to simplify your life and reduce waste. Shauna Sadowski is the sustainability director for Annie's, where she oversees practices like recyclable packaging and improving the sustainability of Annie's supply chain. And Mike San Giacomo is president and CEO of Recology, a municipal disposal and resource recovery company that does business in California, including here in San Francisco, but as well as Nevada, Oregon, Washington, over 600,000 residents and 95,000 businesses. These four sustainability champions will tonight will do a sort of intellectual dumpster dive into how to reinvent the idea of trash. So let's get into it. Jared, I want to start with you to give us from your perspective of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency sort of the high-level view of how are we doing with trash? How much are we generating? How much are we recovering? And how has that shifted in the last few years?
Thanks, Joel, and thanks to all the people that are here. It's hard to get a room full of people to talk about zero waste, but we have one in San Francisco tonight, so thanks for coming out. The picture today is we have about a 34% recycling rate. So as a nation, we produce about 250 million tons of waste, and we recycle 34% of that. So compared to a place like San Francisco, that's not so great, where they're at 80% compared to a place like New York, where it's at about 11%. That's pretty good. Unfortunately, the trend since the 1960s has been that we recycle more, but we're also producing a lot more. So as a total amount, we're not doing that great because we produce more and more waste, of which we recycle a little bit more, but we're still consuming a lot. So the trend nationally at a household level, there's a lot of room for improvement. Our estimates, though, already what we're doing today is enough to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from about 33 million vehicles. So what we're doing currently, that 34% recycling rate, is like taking 33 million cars off the street.
And that's just to explain, I think you need to explain the relationship between trash and car exhaust, that trash gives off greenhouse gases. Talk a little bit about that connection.
So, yeah, in San Francisco, we always talked about what you see as the top of the waste berg, and underneath is all the stuff it takes to produce anything. There's an average of about 70 pounds of upstream waste for every pound of product that you get. Something like gold, an ounce of gold is about 300 tons of upstream waste to get that 1 ounce of gold. So we don't think about all that stuff. When you do, and then when you think about methane being 25 times more potent than average greenhouse gases like CO2, when you throw stuff in a hole in the ground, a landfill, even though we think of landfills as very engineered and lined, they are at the bottom to stop pollution of groundwater. They're not really that, they're very porous when you look up. So there are methane recovery systems, and new landfills have them, but the majority of landfills in our country still do not. So it's a big contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and as we'll hear from the other panelists, a lot of what's going into landfills across our country is food and organic material, and that produces more methane than other minerals.
And when we're, it's not just the trash that's rotting, giving off methane that contributes to global warming, but when we throw away less and recycle more, we're also saving the energy that went into making things to get wasted. We're probably the water, the incredible amount of energy goes into moving and treating water. So it goes up the supply chain in terms of what we're saving from a greenhouse gas perspective when we reduce trash.
Absolutely. And you know, since the 1970s, when Earth Day was founded 43 years ago, back then the mantra was reduce, reuse, recycle. And as the environmental movement became more sophisticated and we're dealing with things, you know, beyond the realm of anyone's understanding, what goes into chemicals and endocrine disruption and global warming, we kind of forgot those basic issues. But what we're now discovering is many of the things that we care about, from climate change to what's in our products, can also be solved if you deal with zero waste. And a lot of what we'll hear about tonight is what you can do in your home and what communities are doing. Business has got this for a long time. Companies like Toyota and GM and DuPont, for them, waste is a waste of money. And if you can close production cycles to get zero waste, that's made sense for a long time. So when we in San Francisco said we wanted a zero waste goal, people were like, you're crazy. No one has a zero waste goal. And the first one we pointed to was DuPont. They're like, they have a zero waste goal? So it's been mainstream in especially chemical processes and big companies for a long time. Because ultimately, who wants to waste? No one wants to waste. If you ask that question, do you think waste is a good thing? No one's going to say, yeah, I'm a big advocate of waste.
But waste is something that is just a product of my lifestyle. The things that I like to do, the things that I get to do, the lifestyle that I get to lead, it creates waste. So what's the problem?
It doesn't have to, is the point. This is a choice, and it's really a design choice. We can do things at the way back end to create systems that Mike and families have created to reduce the amount of waste that they take. But really, this is, on a macro level, we have to design products that can be reused, that the waste and material in them can be made into new products. So rather than just thinking about how we do the systems of recycling, how we get more food into places, we really need to think about why are we buying food, 40% of which ends up in the landfill. We're obviously not buying things in the right way or designing things in the right way if those products end up in the landfill.
So how much of this, and we'll talk to Bea about this in a minute, is the result of that our lifestyles have changed and we're doing a lot more out of the home? So we're eating a lot more out of the home, so we have waste, even if it's, you know, a bottle, not fast food. Or, you know, we have all this stuff that we're out and about. And, you know, when you're at home, you can control it more. We'll hear more about a zero-waste home in a second, but is that a contributor to this?
Well, part of the failure of the environmental movement is telling people what they can't do. You will not win anything in a society where there are billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent on advertising to buy stuff. You simply can't tell people you should buy less. You can, but I'm not sure how successful it would be. Rather, you need to reinvent how we consume and use products so that they can be turned into new products. Because it's really about how you move resources through a system. And if you've spent all that time and energy mining the gold, it makes no sense once you've got a cell phone to throw it in a landfill.
Right. So, Bea Johnson, let's talk about your journey. It's been an interesting one for a number of years. Talk a little bit about you and your husband and your two boys and sort of what you've been doing at home and of course, the subject of your book and blogs. Talk a little bit about Zero Waste Home.
So for us, it started in 2006. Sorry, guys, you won't have subtitles tonight. It started in 2006 when...
It started in 2006, sorry.
Thank you. Well, we might have subtitles for you, too. But we were living in a large home in the East Bay, and we decided that we wanted to move closer to an area where we could just have everything closer to us, be able to walk to schools and restaurants and movie theaters, things like that. Because where we lived, we had to basically take the car everywhere. So we decided to move to this little downtown in Muir Valley. And so in the meantime, we rented a small apartment and only moved in with the necessities and put everything else in the storage. And we found that by living just with the necessities, we had much more time in our hands. So we were sold basically on a simple lifestyle from that moment. And then once we did move into a home in Muir Valley, which happened to be half the size of our previous home, we had to sell off a lot of our belongings. And we really started looking at all the things we had and evaluated them and let go of probably about 80% of our belongings. And then from there, we had, again, all that time in our hands. And just from simplifying our lives, we basically used that time to educate ourselves on environmental issues. And what we found was really scary. And we felt, oh, my gosh, we need to do something about what's happening, at least for the future of our children, because we just felt bad for what we would leave behind for our kids. So my husband quit his job to start a sustainability consulting company, and I tackled the home. So I kind of started just with the usual totes and reusable cloth bags. I mean, my own cloth bags to carry bulk, to buy food from bulk bins and carry them home. And then I started bringing jars to the store to purchase meat, fish, cheese, and deli. And from there, we really started tackling everything in the home. And it came to the point where we realized that zero waste really happens outside the home. It's the decisions that we make at the store. It's the decisions that we make when we're buying things that really will make an impact on how much waste you generate in your home. So we added refuse to the 4 R's of the reduce, reuse, recycle, rot, and we found that by refusing the things that we do not need, then we were able to cut a huge amount of waste and basically stop. Because when we take things that we don't really need, we're creating a demand to make more, and we're perpetuating unsustainable practices. So once we stopped these things, then things kind of got easier, and then we really started paying more and more attention to our consumption. So it's today for us, zero waste is all on autopilot. It's, if I didn't write a book about it and a blog about it, we wouldn't think about it. It's totally on automatic at our house. Everyone is on board. Not that my husband was on board with it originally. He thought it was going to be more costly, and I asked him to actually compare our spending from the pre-zero waste life and the zero waste life, and we found that we were saving about 40% on our overall spending.
And you're literally at zero waste?
No, I mean, with the manufacturing practices in place today, it's not possible. I mean, we have a home that we need to care for. There are repairs that need to be done on a regular basis, such as caulking the bathroom and little electrical repair. Things like that have generated a little bit of waste. So our yearly waste output, our landfill waste fits in a jar, in a quart-size jar. Those are really items that... again, are generally linked to repairs or the backing of the stamps or bike repair. I mean, basically, little things you wouldn't think about that in the end end up to the landfill.
So I'm really interested in this downsizing thing, because I think a lot of people listen to this and they say, yeah, well, good for them. You know, nice that they did that, but I don't really want to do that. But you are saying that to a certain extent, the stuff you owned kind of owned you in a way that you, when you got rid of it, or some of it at least, you had more time. Talk a little bit about your relationship with stuff and how that's changed.
Yeah, well, once we started letting go of things, we got this amazing sense of freedom, feeling that our life was much lighter. And to me, the less I have, the richer I feel. That's how kind of it all progressed for me. And I think it's especially because we feel like we're saving so much more time. There is a big misconception that zero waste is more expensive and it's going to cost more. Take more time to do. But in the end, it's the complete opposite. And it's really, I mean, beyond the environmental benefits, it's really saving money and saving time that has really kept us on track. And then you also have the health aspect, which people also don't think about. But when you live a zero waste lifestyle, you end up being much healthier also.
Did it start hard and got easier? Is it kind of like a marathon where you hit a wall and kind of, you know, sort of
Yeah, well, especially through? When we started, there were no blogs out there. There was not really information. So we had to kind of test a lot of extremes. We did some things that we'll never try again, but we had to try them just to see if it was possible. And then, for example, I shampooed my hair with, I did the no poo. Which means you use baking soda in your hair in order to shampoo your hair, because I was able to buy baking soda in bulk, and I thought this would be a good idea. But I did that for 6 months, and then I started feeling like not myself. I went on a walk with my girlfriends, and right before, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to try shampoo today. And I tried it, and my girlfriend saw me like, oh, my God, what did you do? And I'm like, I used shampoo. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, that was so. Then we went back to shampoo. Although today we're not using shampoo, we found a shampoo bar or an all-purpose bar that works for us. But it was one of those things that we had to try, see how far we can take it. For example, also, there are things that we found were not worth the effort. For example, we try to eliminate recycling altogether. Sorry, Mike. we wanted, because it was part of our zero waste journey, we wanted to see if we could live without recycling. But that meant basically making paper out of all the paper that was coming home. And we get quite a bit from the kids' schools. And we've been able to tell teachers, please don't send as much paper. But still, we were getting a few. And making paper in the summer is fun. But in the winter, when it's wet and it doesn't dry, then things mold, it's just like a total pain. And then after that, it was also the other thing that we have in our recycling today is, for example, the bottles of wine that friends bring over. And zero recycling meant saying no to wine from our friends. Are you kidding me? Yeah. That was really socially restricting. So we decided to give that up. We get our bottles refilled at a local winery, but we still encourage our friends to bring wine.
If only.
So we're all on recycling.
If only there was a wine shampoo. I don't know.
Whoa.
Shauna, so you're running sustainability at Annie's. First of all, for folks who don't know Annie's, give us a little profile of what you do.
Sure. So Annie's, for those of you who don't know, we're an organic and natural foods company based in Berkeley, California. We make macaroni and cheese, cookies and crackers, the one with the bunny on it, and salad dressing. So we have over 125 products, and we're available nationwide and in Canada in over 25,000 retail locations.
And so your job, because we know lots of heads of sustainability, and some of them are involved with the facilities, the offices, and sort of greening the operations. Some of them are helping figure out for the product design. Some are looking up the supply chain. Talk a little bit about what your job encompasses.
Yeah, for us, sustainability is, at the end of the day, we're a food company, and food comes from the land. And therefore, from a sustainability perspective, we must understand where our food is coming from. And so that's where the majority of my work is really focused on in the sustainability. So it is very much supply chain focused. So it's looking at from the farm and the ingredients, how they transform from land to crop that's harvested to ingredient that's processed, that's then made into a product by a manufacturer and put together and put on shelf. So it's really kind of looking at that full life cycle, but really thinking about that very start and very beginning of the farm.
Jared was talking before about, from a business perspective, waste is lost profit. It's very much a financial cost, less so than obviously with individuals in homes. How much of have you been able to squeeze out of the system? And where do you find the biggest amounts of waste in the system?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting question, because it isn't, we have our own four walls at Berkeley, and there's certainly, we have our zero waste goals in the office, but it's because we need to be focusing upstream. We have a lot of different initiatives in place looking at those upstream efforts. So just by way of example, on the farming side, organic is a big part of what we do. And how that relates to waste is really important, because waste is not just the hard materials, it's also the pollutants that come in the system. So if you think about farming, we've moved to a system where we use a lot of synthetic nitrogen. And we've, I think, increased 6 or 7-fold between 1960 and 1990 the amount of nitrogen fertilizer that it's used. And it's used to build more and better crops. However, most crops, they don't take all that nitrogen in. They can lose up to 40%, which means you're losing it in the water and polluting in the soil. And it leads to dire consequences from hypoxia zones, basically these dead zones that you see at the end of the Mississippi River. And so there's a lot of waste that's occurring on that. So our answer to that is really looking at how can organic be a better solution. We have more than 85% of our products are coming from organic ingredients, and we see it as a real way to address those supply chain issues, because we don't use synthetic nitrogen fertilizer in organic farming, period. We look to understand how we can use crop rotations as a way to bring soil nutrients to the land. And we look at composting and essentially looking to work within the natural cycles that nature has and to mimic those. And I think, to be honest, you know, organic has a lot to offer in that, but we still have so much more to learn. There's so many great and wonderful practices that I'm seeing amongst farmers that are truly being innovative with the types of crops that they're growing, when they do their crop rotations, how they mix it up. So it's really, I think, still untapped as to how much further we can go that's going to get us to a fuller cycle. And that's the farming side. The manufacturing side, we work with manufacturers as well.
So what are you manufacturing? You're manufacturing noodles? Is that part considered?
Yes, so the pasta converting. Right. So basically from, you know, coming from wheat into, you make it into a flour and then you make it into a pasta grain. So working with the folks who are doing that, pasta and then the cheese as well, it goes from a dairy fluid into a dried fluid that becomes the packet and that's put into the mac and cheese boxes is one example. And so we work with those manufacturers to better understand their operations. So there's a lot of engagement, a lot of conversation that takes place. And it's because there's so many different products we have a lot of different conversations. I'm certainly learning a lot in the process, too, about what challenges they face and what ways that we might help be a resource to them. But we meet with all of our suppliers every year, which is quite unique, and we talk to them. We have a chance to talk to them about what's important to us, what's important to our consumers, and really kind of convey the information to them. And this past year, actually, we started doing a Green Bernie Award. So we collect all this information on energy and waste, and then cross, you know, do a benchmark against them, and then we awarded the manufacturer who was doing, we thought, the best, had a diversion rate on the waste side of 70% and also emission reductions from a carbon side.
So what's the biggest source of waste that you haven't figured out how to tackle?
You know, I think the one that seems like the most obvious one is the packaging side, but it's I'm not going to actually go there because, like I mentioned, it's upstream. Packaging does play a role, and it's the tangible, and we do have that challenge. There are certainly products we have that don't, that can't be recycled, and they go into landfill. But as a percentage of our total weight, it's actually about 5%, so it's actually pretty low. Most of the products that we have for packaging can be recycled.
But that's what people see. They see
right.
The package,
right.
And you've got Bea and her and others who say, but I love this product, but I can't recycle the
right.
package.
Right.
What do you, can you work on that?
We are. But it's trying, Joel, I'm trying.
Still it's in bulk.
yeah, that's that too, bulk side. You know, it is challenging. In part, the technology, I don't think, the technology's not there, the cost is not there, but there are actually different companies within our food space and the natural organic space who are looking into it and looking at compostability as another one. But I these conversations are happening. People know that we want it, but it's just not, it doesn't make business sense at this point. So that's something that we do continue to work on and talking to those who are in the packaging industry to figure that out.
And I'd imagine that part of the problem is that you're just too small. And it's not just, I mean, even a very large company can be too small in terms of trying to move the market, even if you said, I want, literally, I know these are out there, edible packaging.
Right.
Or at least, you know, bio-based packaging. You're a small company.
Right, and that's in part why we do actually talk to others in the industry and figure out what they're doing. We're members of an industry association where we have these conversations. So it's not just us, it's us and others in the food space to see what ways that they're trying to tackle the challenges. So it's definitely not something that we can do alone by any means. We need to work across the board and probably outside even of the food industry.
So, Mike, it may be symbolic that they sat you at the end of the line here, because as a waste disposal company and waste recovery company, you get the fruits of everybody's failure in a certain sense. You see the failures of things that couldn't be disposed of or couldn't be reused or refused, although you do a lot of recycling. One of the things that strikes me as really interesting about your company is that you have a program called Waste Zero. Strikes me as an interesting program for a company who's in the waste business. Tell us about that, and how do you do that and stay in business?
Well, we're in one regard, we're extremely different from other players in our industry. We have kind of reinvented ourselves as a resource recovery company. So we look at, and we're extremely used to being last because we get all the stuff nobody else wants. And they put us at the last end of the parades too because we drive our old trucks around. But we get all this stuff, and it's, you know, we're looking at it as resources that we can do something else with. All of that packaging you're talking about, if it's paper, that can be recycled and we recover it and get it recycled. A lot of the plastics, I don't think they're the best things in the world to use, but we can recover a lot of that. And for now, we're finding people that will reuse that stuff to make something out of it. Some of it goes into similar types of products, like your number one and number two plastics. So the threes through sevens are probably, I would call it downcycled, but they do something with it. But, you know, we're looking at potential technologies that will allow us. I mean, all that stuff's made out of petrochemical polymers. So we think there are ways, and they're not perfected yet, but they're getting closer, that are going to allow us to take those polymers and break them back down into the basic oil product and allow it to be reused for the next generation of polymers. So those kind of things are going on. Food waste or organic matter that we collect, I don't really consider that failures. A lot of people will buy fresh food, and there's parts of it you can't eat. But it will all break down into a soil-like product. What we're principally doing now is making a compost with it. But the food that gets spoiled can be added to that. Paper that is soiled can be added to that. And we have, every time we get more of that material to use and make compost with, we think, how are we going to sell all this extra production now? And every time we have extra production, more people come to us and want it. We work a lot with organic farmers. We have agronomists on the staff now who will go out to the farm, sample the soil, understand what it is the farmer's going to plant, and deliver them a blend of compost and other natural products that will give that soil the nutrients it needs to generate to produce the product. We are doing some work with the local water utility to take a lot of that organic matter and digest it. So the composting process done right doesn't generate methane gas. It does generate some off gases that we run through biofilters so we don't get emissions that are harmful. But we're now trying to get as much of that matter as possible digested so that we can, by doing it in an enclosed environment, create the gas that forms in landfills but largely dissipates into the air because landfills, as Jared mentioned, don't do a good job of capturing the gases. No matter what other companies in this industry will tell you, I don't believe they capture anywhere much over 50% of the gas that's generated. But if we can do that in a digester and capture basically all of it, that's going to become our next generation truck fuel. So as long as we use trucks to collect refuse, we want to be able to power them with our own production. And I would think within the next year, we're probably going to be doing that, generating gas at some of our facilities that we are going to then power our own trucks with.
So you've gone from being a trash removal company or even a recycling company into sort of a materials broker, where you're finding where does this material have its highest, best value, and finding markets for that. I mean, that's remarkable. Is it profitable, first of all? Can you make money doing that?
You can. There are obviously various values to all these different commodities. In areas where disposal fees are getting high, this is one of those areas. By avoiding the disposal fees, the cost of transportation to disposal sites, you can take that avoided cost and apply it to the processing that you're otherwise going to do and help, in effect, subsidize the cost of making products like compost. And you then have done something productive with that material at hopefully a lower cost than putting it into an expensive landfill and avoiding and generating some value out of it.
How does all this change the relationship with your customers, not just the homeowners, but the commercial, the tens of thousands of commercial? Because we all, you know, individuals and businesses, you know, we throw stuff into the trash can or the dumpster or the recycling bin or the compost bin, but we don't think about that. Does it change that relationship? Does it change the conversation you have with them?
It really has. Not that many years ago, it was a truck driver who had the relationship, the communication, the interrelationship with the customer. He/she showed up, dumped a bin, and left. These days, in places like San Francisco, where we have mandatory composting, mandatory recycling ordinances, we've got to go talk to all those customers about what they're generating, what's the best way to separate it so that we can maximize the recovery in the process, reduce their costs of providing of getting that service from us, because we want it to be a win-win for both. And so we are talking to every commercial customer we have on a fairly regular basis just to go back in and reinforce what it is they're doing, that they get the program. The back rooms of restaurants. We go in, our staff goes in and trains the food prep staff on how to segregate food waste in the prep process from the film plastic that's a contaminant of the food waste. They actually talk to busboys who are cleaning off plates about how to separate the material. Well, there's huge turnover in the back rooms of restaurants, so we go back on a regular basis. We inspect carts to see what's in them, and if we see there's a customer that's slipping, we go back in and do a little reinforcement.
Yeah.
On residential routes, currently we just leave notes about, we have these little cards about, you know, what is wrong with your set out if there is something wrong with it, and the customer gets that.
So let's talk a little bit about San Francisco, not just because we're here, but because it really is, I think, a case study of how, you know, what happens when things go right. And Jared, you were the head of the Department of the Environment for the city and county of San Francisco before you ascended to the federal government. And so you were really the one on the ground working with the restaurants, in addition, you know, educating. And San Francisco does have this zero waste mandate by 2020, is that correct? How hard is it to affect change at the city level?
So, really one of the things to think about for every community listening is that most garbage contracts are done at a local level. There aren't state garbage contracts. They're very, very rarely even county garbage contracts. So, or as we now want to think about it, recycling and zero waste contracts. So the ability for communities to shape the future of how their material is collected is in their hands. And the cost differential, you know, when we did the survey, there's really people in San Francisco are paying about the middle of the range of what they pay to have someone pick it up and put it in a hole in the ground. So the economics of what you were asking Mike about is pretty key. The first thing that we did is say, we're going to pay a company more the more they recycle. The more they send it to landfill, the less we're going to pay them. And so that is a big economic change in our country that we need to see, because if you're incenting people to send it to landfill, you will never get to zero waste. In San Francisco, we had the privilege of having voters that elect people that care about these issues and members of the Board of Supervisors who unanimously vote for these things where they don't agree on much else. So we got a zero waste goal by 2020. The city, I don't think Mike mentioned, I think is about 80% now.
Yeah.
80% is achievable. Really what we did is we very scientifically went and looked at what was still being thrown away. And one of the things that was being thrown away was food. So we sat down with Recology. And actually, Recology, Mike was being modest, but back in the day, they were called Sunset Scavenger. So they'd actually come a full circle, right? The people in the 1900s that were picking up the material in San Francisco reused all of it. We were probably at 90% diversion back in, you know, before the earthquake. And so we're coming back to a place we've been before. And then we said, you know, worked on this rate structure to say, if you're the Hilton Hotel, if you're SCOMA's, you need to pay less the more you recycle. Because then they're like, we want in, right? And a lot of these systems we've talked about at a business level, at a home level, it's really about institutionalizing it, making it easy and convenient. If it's too difficult, no one's going to do it. And so as we went around and asked people, why would you help recycle? Would it, with climate change a big issue? People said, about in San Francisco, about 10% of people said, we would do this because of global climate change. When you put cash, that's about 85% of people will do it, right?
It's funny how that works.
Right. So even a place that thinks of itself as very altruistic and green, the real green they care about is the cash in their pocket. Yeah. And zero waste is a way of saving money and resources. So another thing that is a big thing for EPA nationally is jobs. For every one job that you create by putting it in landfill, you create from 5 to 10 jobs by recycling or composting it. So this is a big jobs gain. There was a report that came out last year that said if the nation as a whole achieved a 75% diversion from landfill by 2030, we would add 1.5 million new jobs.
Yeah.
1.5 million new jobs. So people often think there's a lot of sacrifice, this is so difficult. You can save money at the home and business level, and you can create jobs at the same time.
So one thing we haven't talked about I think is important here, because we're talking about things as if we don't want them anymore, we throw them away, we recycle them. But there's another phenomenon that's taking place, and Bea, I want to ask you about this, and actually all of you, and that's sharing, the sharing economy, as it's come to be called. And there are, you know, we've certainly Salvation Army has been around for centuries, perhaps, I don't know. But now there's also through the web, there's and social media, there's things like Yertle and a number of other services that allow us to share things. That seems, you know, because we all have stuff we don't want. You got rid of it. I don't know how. You can talk about that. But you know, this is a whole other way that we can reduce waste. I mean, do you see that? Was that part of your...
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, that decluttering is a huge part. I mean, it is reduced. The reduce aspect is decluttering. A lot of people don't see the correlation between decluttering and doing something good for the environment, but it is primordial. When we basically declutter our homes and donate our items, we're putting these items back on the market, we're boosting the second-hand market, we're basically sharing those unused items with other people so that people that are looking for those items don't need to buy new. I mean, I have very specific examples of when I went to an award ceremony with my son. He had to be dressed all in, you know, in a suit, was looking for a pair of black pants for him, could not find one anywhere in a thrift store. I know that there is a pair of black pants out there, size 12 boys, sitting in someone's closet. So I think when it's super important to just really let go of things and be able to share those resources with other people. I mean, whether they're already made resources, they are resources. They should be shared with other people. And for the whole sharing economy, I mean, I'm a big believer in that too. I think we can all, I mean, for example, when It's also from the fact that we live minimally, but by living minimally, for example, our wardrobes are fit in carry-ons so that we can basically rent our home when we go on away on vacations or on weekends. All we have to do is pull down our carry-on, throw our wardrobes in it, zip it, and we're out the door, and then someone else can use our home. I think it's crazy for all these great resources to be sitting there even when we're on vacation, sitting there unused. It goes the same with cars, putting them, using services such as Get Around to share your car. And I mean, it doesn't really, in some areas, it's more difficult. I mean, where I live, everyone has two cars. They don't necessarily are looking to rent them, but we still have put ours on the market because that's where we want everyone to do. And we hope that more people will be renting out their cars too.
I'm still struck by that. Making a 12-year-old wear a suit in Marin County. Shauna, one of the opportunities here for a consumer-facing company like yours is educating consumers. Mm-hmm. You have your packages, you have your advertising, your marketing, to help them understand lots of things about not just the environment, about nutrition and perhaps many other things. What do you see consumers responding to? Have you tried this, first of all?
Well, we definitely use our packaging as a way to communicate our values. And I have to say, our consumers are the most loving, loyal fans that I've ever met in my lifetime working at a company. It's truly a pleasure. We literally get handwritten notes from students in, kindergarten and, well, maybe they're not quite writing then, but whatever, age group it might be, and they're writing us notes and parents as well. We share information on the back of pack about organic, about supporting farmers, about, having a little pictorial that actually says a cow made this milk that then became this cheese. Like, the idea of connecting people to real food. And even though we are a consumer, we're a product that's packaged, we know that it comes from the land, and being able to really convey that. And people do connect to it. And we use our website, of course, as a means to convey information. We have a huge Facebook following, and we use that for, we did an Earth Month little factoid on the number of organic products we have, and a lot of people are very responsive to that. And clearly, we're doing well as a company, so clearly people are responding to it in terms of just they appreciate what we're doing, and they're voting with their fork.
So you're organic and marketing towards an audience that's probably predisposed to do a lot of this stuff. Do you see this translated into the larger, I don't know how to call them in a
Absolutely.
Way that...
I mean, the natural and organic food consumer and channel is actually about a third of our market. We have a lot going into other more kind of mainstream consumers. So what they might be attracted to, can relate. I mean, it just... Because you might not first think of organic, it doesn't mean you don't want to buy better for your family.
Yeah.
And so it's being able to make it accessible, and I really think we are a more affordable organic, and that's a good thing for everyone. And the more that we can figure out ways to work through the supply chain to reduce costs, to make it more affordable, it's going to be a win-win for everybody. But I think, getting to this conversation about shared resources, I think about it from our perspective really of shared knowledge. We need more knowledge out there as well. And we do it within the industry, talking to other companies, but farmers as well, getting more research into the hands of farmers, because they are the ones who are going to innovate best. And when we're thinking about all these aspects of water and energy and soil, that is the crux of it for a food company, they have the best tools at their disposal. We just need to make sure they have the best research available.
We're going to get to questions in about 3 or 4 minutes, so if you have them, there are some mics, I think, or you need to step up. There will be mics up there in a second. Mike, I know you've worked a lot with Bill McDonough, the architect, designer of renown, and he talks a lot about the fact of zero is not a very worthy goal. Here we are talking about zero waste as if it's some high ideal, and it's an incredible achievement for a household, a company, certainly a city. But is zero really what we all want to be striving for? How do you think about this, and how does what you've done with McDonough inform your work?
Bill is an interesting character. He's done some really fantastic building designs that are as sustainable as you're going to find recovering energy, not emitting waste. And we're talking with him about the future waste facilities that allow us to get as close to zero waste as you can possibly get. And we'll probably have those built within the next, say 10 years, that process material but don't allow anything harmful into the environment. But in looking at that, we're looking at upcycling everything that we touch, taking food waste and digesting it and doing energy recovery from it, and then taking that the residual from that process and composting it and putting it back in the soil. Really good things. Taking plastics that right now, the little pieces of it, like bottle caps that fall through the recycling equipment, and a lot of that ends up in landfills still, but finding ways to recover that and maybe doing something productive with it. Bill has an idea of taking those plastic bottle caps and making some small number of parts out of them that can be assembled, say in third world countries that need cheap housing, that can be assembled to build a one-room home, maybe an 8x8 home for a small family, that can have water storage in the corner pillars and grow something on the roof. All those kind of things are fascinating. We just want to keep looking at... Right now, we take a tremendous amount of material and put it in empty shipping containers and send it to China because they're using all the stuff. And those containers are going to go back empty otherwise, but we want to try and figure out, are there ways that we can use that stuff here and not downcycle it, but at least keep it coming back as more of the same product that that it was in the first place, or if we can even find ways to make it something better, why not? Waste plastics, if they can be melted back down safely with no harm to the environment into the petroleum that it was beforehand, well, that can be reprocessed and something done with it. And you know, I think we can get there, and I think that those are the kind of things we want to do. You mentioned the scavengers back in the old days. Those were days when the waste stream, that's what we colloquially call what everybody throws away, the waste stream was very different back then. There were no plastics being thrown away because they didn't exist before, 1945, 1950, somewhere around there. People fed food waste to animals, so there wasn't a lot of material to compost. Urban environments have gotten more crowded. People don't have places to have home composting. They don't have a lot of storage for stuff, so they need to get it out, and we got to find something productive to do with it. And as the waste stream keeps changing, we got to keep changing what it is we do and reinventing ourselves.
Right. 25 years ago, we didn't think about e-waste, for example. Now we all have tons of it in drawers that we don't know what to do with.
Right.
As a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting Reduce, Reuse, Recycle, Let's Talk Trash with Jared Blumenfeld, the Pacific Southwest Administrator for the U.S. EPA, Bea Johnson, the author of Zero Waste Home, Shauna Sadowski, the Sustainability Director at Annie's, and Mike San Giacomo, President and CEO of Recology. And I'm Joel McCower, Chairman and Executive Editor of GreenBiz Group. Let's take some questions from the audience. We're looking for some short questions on a very, very big topic. Go for it.
Hi, my question is for Mike with regards to certain waste materials that actually, I was wondering what are they and if there are any, I think there are, that cost more to reprocess by recycling than to process if you're creating new?
Great question. The city of San Francisco is now at an 80% diversion rate, equivalent to a recycling rate. We think of that last 20, about 10 is stuff that is recoverable, recycled material that could be recycled, material that could be composted. It's that last 10% that we haven't got a clue yet what to do with economically. It's composites. It's packaging that has multiple layers of different types of products. That the cost of separating those apart and recovering them all is just too expensive that nobody wants them.
athletic shoes for a long time were a problem that, you know, people wear these things out and they end up in our case, in the black cart, the garbage cart, and we didn't have a use for them. Well, we don't yet have a facility that can easily recycle them, but we've identified and have chatted with Nike. They have now a program where they will take back, if you deliver them to them, they will take back any manufacturer's athletic shoes, cut them up. The bottom layer goes, for example, into sports courts, that sort of thing, and the other layers go into different types of filler materials in products to be manufactured. But it's those composites that we really have to work on and figure out what to do with, because right now the economics of recycling them isn't there.
Next question over here.
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I go to Presidio Graduate School, and a group of students and I had a project last semester where we looked at how to engage consumers in how to separate compostables from recyclables from what goes into landfill. We found that most people in our school and in most conscientious places still get it wrong. So I want to know, instead of going back to all these places and talking to these individual customers, have you considered how to engage people on a broader scale to meet them where they're at, possibly with gamification of packaging and regular items that you see in the bin so that they don't have to linger over a bin but can enjoy learning how to sort?
So new and innovative ways to engage consumers, games, anything else?
Some of the things we do, I don't mean to be monopolizing this, but some of the things we do are we have somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people a year tour facilities. So they can see firsthand the results of what people throw away. Probably about half of those are kids, and they go home and help mom and dad get it right. We have a couple times a year packaging designers come down and see, have conversations with us, but before the conversation, we take them on a tour of what we call the pit, where all the stuff that we haven't figured out how to recycle yet ends up. So they get to see that. They get to see the product of their waste. They go and see the recycling plants and how much material is there. So we'll talk with lots of groups like that, and I'll throw in a plug for an artist in residence program that we have that is designed to make people think differently about what you throw away. We want you to think about that material that you don't have a use for anymore, that somebody else might. We, for 23 years now, have had a stream of artists that go through our program and make art out of recycled products or recycled material, recyclable material, stuff that nobody else really has come up with a use for. But you know, we've had anywhere from metal sculpture and, you know, painting with recycled paint to clothing items made from recycled material to a symphony called Junkestra that was performed on stuff that was found in the waste stream and not changed at all. And you can see a lot of that at the United Terminal at the SFO from now through roughly the end of October, where there's about 60 or 70 pieces on display in the airport. So yeah, all those kinds of things, we like to just get in people's heads and mix it up a little bit and get you to think about just doing things differently.
There's a giant styrofoam Humvee there that's attracting a crowd.
I was just going to say, I mean, one of the things we try to do is make it fun on the packaging. So recycle this or reuse it. Come up with a creative way to use this packaging as a bookmark. And so because a lot of kids are reading the back of it, it's getting them engaged too. And I'll say, you know, I'm getting my 2-year-old to learn how to compost, learn how to recycle. Like, you start young. And to Mike's point, you get them, I mean, kids are teaching their parents now how to do this. It's definitely a change in a generational side.
Let's take a question there.
So all non-B Corp business entity types exist primarily to make a profit. There's been this proliferation of these free e-waste cycle companies, and that business model just doesn't make sense to me. I was hoping someone on the panel could address what's happening in this particular market. And is it truly a sustainable industry?
So these are companies that take your cell phone or your PC or your perhaps TV that you don't want, and they the promise to recycle it in a responsible way. And are you paying for that, or is it so free? Or?
There's no guarantee that it's done responsibly.
I know, no, but I know that's the promise. But and do you, as a consumer, pay for this?
No, it's free. Yeah. That's the selling point.
Do anyone know the business model, Jared? Is this something you come across at EPA?
I mean, there's a large number of companies, and so I'm not going to come out and say that any of them do it 100% sustainably. But the market for it is twofold. One is reuse in the developing world. So if you have an iPhone 4 that can be reconditioned and sold to a country like Brazil or Nigeria, there's a huge secondary market. And then the other element is taking those components apart. There's a lot of precious metals. I mentioned gold before, but also the chips themselves can be reused. So they have significant value.
We've sold some of our, like, we've had a broken iPhone that we've sold on eBay because there are people that are buying these things to repair them and then refurbish them and resell them. And there is also, in my town, there is a store, a little store that will buy things like that. So we haven't recycled any of our e-waste. We've actually sold it and made money out of it. So we had, like, an iPad with, like, a broken screen. Same thing, we sold it. We didn't buy a new one or anything, but just to let you guys know. We got $80 for it, so hey.
Sweet.
Yeah.
As far as I know, there's no recycle program, at least not in San Francisco Recology, to recycle apparel. And Mike touched on this a little bit, but my question is based on, for example, the case of polyester, there's double the amount of polyester globally that goes into textiles than that goes into packaging, like Coke bottles and the like. So my question is around that. What's the status and feasibility of recycling apparel, even non-polymer ones, cotton, wool, polyester, nylon, et cetera?
We have the technology to turn a soda bottle, a number one PET bottle, back into a soda bottle of some recycled content. Is that possible with a polyester shirt?
We haven't found the technology yet. But it's one of those things we're looking at.
Is the problem because that they're, unlike a soda bottle, which is uniform in its manufacturing, the components in terms of the materials, an article of clothing could have any number of different kinds of dyes?
I would consider clothing made of polyester one of those composites that are still a problem, that you've got to separate the different materials that are in there to make them recyclable. Years ago, this company used to collect rags and reprocess them and sell them as wiping rags and Turkish towels and everything in between. But that day ended when polyester came out because they don't work. We now are trying to look at alternative things to do with that stuff, but it's so far everything we've looked at is just too expensive.
Goodwill is in contact with recyclers. So, for example, when we have worn-out clothing, which doesn't happen in your, very often, but when we do have worn-out clothing, we put it in a bag and we write scraps on it. And the Goodwill has contacts with recyclers, so they get them recycled that way.
Great. I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, my name's Sarah. And so I had a question in regards to our landfills. Two questions. What are we going to do when our landfills are filled? And the next question related to that would be the technology, or how close are we to introducing potentially gasification here in California or the United States? So maybe that's a question for the two gentlemen.
So in 1990, in Earth Day 1990, one of the big issues was overflowing landfills. There's a lot of talk about this. And we haven't heard a lot about it lately because it turns out that landfills weren't necessarily overflowing. There were some symbolic things. Talk us a little bit about, is there a landfill shortage?
Not yet. There's lots of capacity around. It might not always be the nearest place to where you want to take your material, but California probably has enough landfill capacity for at least 50 years if we continue to dispose of material at the current rate.
And is that true in the Northeast U.S. where there's
lots of landfill. Just to be clear, the concept of zero waste is sending zero amount of waste to landfill or incineration. You talked about gasification, which for pretty much all intents and purposes is another way of describing incineration, burning things at a very high temperature. So the goal is to not burn things or send things to landfill. That's what zero waste stands for. And so the goal is to move communities towards And you know, if you get to 80%, you're doing incredibly well. And San Francisco will have only 20% of its waste that needs to go to landfill capacity that was designed for 100% of waste. So there's a lot of landfill capacity.
And we don't really even have a standard for zero waste, because I know there's some companies who talk about zero waste, say, well, would they allow up to 5% of their waste to be waste to energy, which is incineration that they can turn into energy. So this is still, I think, an evolving term that's going to ultimately need some definition, so we're all talking about the same thing. Is that true?
I think it's a pretty uniform definition.
Okay.
Yeah. In my mind, yeah.
Uniform in your mind.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm still not sure that answered the question, but we'll go with that for now. So it's time for the last question, and it's a great Inform tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. So Jared, Bea, Shauna, and Mike, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? And let's start with Jared.
60-second idea to change the world, and I have 50 seconds left. I mean, in this space, the two big goals that I have are, one, that when my children are my age, we don't have a Pacific garbage patch. And in order to do that, especially living on the coast of California, we really need to do two things. One, make sure we reduce the amount of waste that's ending up in the ocean. And secondly, really rethink how we treat waste as a whole. So this is a huge opportunity. When you think about environment and what you can do, recycling is it. The best thing we can probably do that we're not doing today is buy recycled. None of us talked about it, but how much do we make sure that the products we are buying have 100% recycled content? And the one thing I would do, if you're asking for one thing, is to start with 100% recycled chlorine-free paper. For the paper we do use, buy recycled.
Paper is the largest ingredient of a landfill.
Yep.
So, Bea?
Tough question, and you said it could be wild, right? So it's to put my book in every American's hand so that everyone can understand that with the zero waste lifestyle, it's a better life. It's improved our life tremendously, and I can only imagine what it would be if a whole society embraced it as a whole. I think it would be unbelievable if it saved us money, saved us time to have basically more time in our hands to spend with our family and have more time to live experiences, basically have less to live more. Then I can only imagine what it would do for a whole society. I think it would be pretty awesome.
And when you finish with the book, please share it with somebody else. Shauna?
Yeah, exactly. Library.
Well, I think at the end of the day, we all eat, and we all eat food. And so two things from that. Go visit a farm. That is, visit a farm in your region. Visit a farm, places you go visit. See the way that different farming systems exist and look at ways that that farm is trying to work in harmony with nature, if it is, and that's a part of the task. The second part is learn and teach how to eat real food, how to get that into our bodies, and how to use it in a way, and this ties into the whole zero waste, too, is you learn to cook. Everyone can learn to cook. Everyone eats. Everyone can learn to cook. So those two pieces.
Goes into a whole different kind of waste reduction process. Mike?
Well, it did occur to me that it's going to cost Bea a lot of money to put that book into everybody's home. But I hope you can do that.
Give access to it. That doesn't mean everyone.
Well, in the course of listening to these last three, I came up with nothing that was either brilliant or terribly funny. And then you went and stole most of my thunder. I think we should all think about eating better quality food, healthier food, enjoying it more, spending more time eating with family and friends, and just focusing a little bit more on those things in life and being a lot less hung up in a rat race of trying to get somewhere where we really don't need to be.
Great.
Can I say a quote?
Very short.
Oh, sorry. It's just a quote that you guys had in one of your ads, and it was, if less is more, then zero is everything.
Ah,
well
put, I think.
Thanks for the free commercial.
Yeah.
That
was sometimes a big fat nothing is a good thing, so that's good. Thanks to Levi Strauss & Company for supporting this event, but thank you to to Mike, Shauna, Bea, and Jared for the great wisdom on and experiences on about zero waste and waste in general. So please join me in giving a round of applause to them. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.